So one last story, which is tied to the origin of the karma management idea. The idea came at a lecture in Perth, Australia, a few years ago, in conjunction with a groundbreaking ceremony. The temple in Perth, Hindu temple there, invited Gurudeva, but Gurudeva wasn't traveling during that time, so Gurudeva had me go instead. And had a nice groundbreaking ceremony for the temple, and they also arranged a lecture at the university there. And so there was a second speaker at the lecture, and so I went first and gave my talk, and the second speaker was the Hindu gentleman from Malaysia, Jagadeesan is his name, wonderful speaker, and an even better singer, a beautiful devotional singer, and his goal is to one day come here so he can sing. Isn't that a sweet goal? Was to come to Kadavul so he can sing to the deity. So he made the comment that you know, Hindu wisdom when presented by Swamis, you know, lots of times is ignored, but the same wisdom is often repackaged into these modern management seminar approaches based on Hindu teachings, and people go to it in great numbers. So it's a very interesting time that you're going to have to repackage your Hinduism in order to make it popular. So that's where we got the idea of putting the karma management in the same terminology as a stress management seminar. You know, same idea. Effectively manage your stress, so effectively manage your karma. So I tried to choose a topic which was broad, and I had a catchword in it, a word to generate interest, so I chose the word enlightenment. Well, let's get the word enlightenment in the talk, and maybe we'll get some people who want to learn about enlightenment. So the subject was worship, meditation, and enlightenment. So the idea that was presented was that sometimes what's preventing us from making spiritual progress is a false concept about enlightenment. You get the sense, you know, from stories and movies and whatever, that enlightenment, or the experience of God in a profound way, happens all at once. Someone's sitting in a cave for a year, and then one day enlightenment comes, or they're sitting under a tree. Nothing's happening, nothing's happening, nothing's happening, and all of a sudden, one morning, they're enlightened. You know, it's coming out of nowhere. Enlightenment is like that. So that's a false concept. It's going from zero consciousness of God to 100% consciousness of God in 1 second, right? That's the false concept. Somehow, we have no consciousness of God at all. We don't have a clue what God is like, where to experience God. You know, we're zero conscious of God. And we're 100% conscious of God the next second. When you think of it that way, you know, it's not that logical, right? Why would it happen that way? Why wouldn't it be gradual? Most things are gradual. Most things don't go from no ability to full ability in 1 second. It's like learning a language. You know, you can't learn a language in 1 second. It takes years. It's a gradual process. Saw some beautiful dancing. Bharatanatyam dancing during our festival. It was impressive. Well, I've been studying for 15 years. You know, I've been studying for 10 years. The time frame in which they'd been studying to achieve that level of skill, which was considerable, was long, right? It's a gradual process. So why would enlightenment be any different? Well, it's not. But because we don't have a good sense of it, we think it might be. But it's wishful thinking. You know, no one goes from zero consciousness of God to 100% consciousness of God in 1 second. It doesn't happen that way. It's a gradual experience. So if we set aside that false concept that enlightenment is instantaneous and goes from 0 to 100%, then we're making some progress right there. Because then we can say, okay, well, striving for 100% consciousness of God, that's not the way to go. How about going from 0 to 5? Or from 5 to 10? Let's try for a more realistic goal here in terms of our experience of God. So when we start looking at it that way, then the question comes up, where do we look? Where is God? You know, how do we experience God? Where do we experience God? So, of course, the easiest place to experience God is in someone like Gurudeva, someone of great attainment. You know, that's also what people are recognizing in him. Island people, in a sense, see, this person is different. State of consciousness they're in is different. So we can look to the great Satgurus, if we're fortunate, and experience God in them. That's actually the easiest way. Because initially, the idea that God is in us, God can't be in us. You don't know what I've done. You don't know what I think. You don't know how impure I am. You don't know how imperfect I am. God can't be in there. So, you know, it's hard to look inside, because of the concepts we have initially. We have to change that eventually. So we want to look in someone else. That's easier. So we look in a great being. That's the place we can look, and we can sense God. So the most interesting part of that is, if we sense God in a great being, what does that mean? Well, we can't experience anything that's not inside of us. That's Gurudeva's teaching. Whatever we see in someone else has to be in us. Otherwise, we could not see it there. The positive qualities and the negative qualities. So if we sense God in someone else, that means the presence of God in us is there and not that hidden from us. It's just we're not used to the idea. But lots of people can't see God in a Satguru. That means the consciousness of God in them isn't that close to the surface, shall we say. So to sense God in someone else, God has to be close to the surface in us. So that's a very interesting idea. So of course, we know Gurudeva's teachings. To look deeply in someone's eyes, you can see God, right? God is the life of your life. So how do you experience God as the life of your life? You look into someone else's eyes and you go past their personality. Whether you like or dislike them, whatever, you go past that outer personality, go deeply into their soul, and you can see God in any person. You just have to go deeply enough. There's a beautiful word, as we know in the Tamil language, called uyir kuyir. God is the life of your life. So we can see God deeply in anyone. And that's the idea, of course, of namaskar. When we greet someone, we try and see their soul, see God in them, not react to them outwardly, but see the inside. So, of course, as we know, we can experience God in the temple. We focused on that during our Inner Search Guru Pranima, explaining that carefully to everyone, and how the mysticism of the temple works, and that Hindus are not idol worshippers, they're quite busy. As was the case during our Inner Search, that of course we're worshipping the spiritual being, the divine being, the God that projects himself through the image. We're not worshipping the image, though the image is treated with respect. Still, it's the being that's projecting himself through the image that's getting the worship. Images like the temporary physical body, as we know. So that's a way in which we can deepen our experience of God quite a bit, is through the temple. And it's a simple way that is effective for children as well. And that's one of the... Maybe we could add that to the list of the greatnesses of Hinduism. It has something for everyone. You know, some traditions are so narrow, if you're not an adult over a certain age, there's nothing for you to do. It's like groups where all you do is meditate. What do the children do? They run around outside and play because there's nothing for them to do. They can't meditate for an hour. So Hinduism has something for everyone. And so everyone can experience God to one degree or another through temple worship. And then, of course, eventually we can worship God inside of us. We may have to clear up some concepts about who we are and get rid of some negativity and so forth to feel that we're a worthy place for God to dwell. But once we get past that, then we can, through the practice of meditation, of course, experience God even more profoundly inside of ourselves. And Gurudeva gives us many, many tools for that. So there's a wonderful verse in the scriptures that govern the monastery, which are called the Saivite Shastras, that was written in just about mid-1970, somewhere around there, 73, around there. So it's talking about the monks, and the monks are young, and this and that, and that the spiritual path, oh, by the way, the spiritual path you're following in this monastery consists of 36 years of training. So they just throw that out at you. So that gives you a sense of how gradual the process is. You know, we don't want to think that things are going to happen quickly. They happen gradually. It's like we're planting a tree that's going to be 3,000 plus years old. You know, so how fast does it grow? It's going to grow slowly. So spiritual life is like that. It's a slow process. But if we work at it consistently, we do make progress. So that 36-year time frame gives a nice sense of how long a certain process can take. It takes many, many years in order for certain things to mature. Om Shanti.